everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 37th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have an action-packed show ahead for you today. We're talking about all of Chicago's major sports teams, including the Bulls, and their two first-round selections in the NBA draft. Later in the show, we'll have a special guest on, and we'll be talking with him about his illustrious NFL career, plus some current NFL news. All of that and more, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at JohnZags, and on Twitter at JohnZSports. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Chicagoland area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, Illinois. If you have any questions, give them a call at 708-247-2100. That's 708-247-2100. Well, I think we all know what we're going to start off talking about today. It's about the Chicago Bulls and their new first-round selections. I don't know if anyone got a chance to watch the NBA draft, but I did, and I was quite nervous to say the least. I was still thinking at the time that the Bulls were going to take Michael Porter Jr., and as I saw him fall down through the first six teams, I was ready to become a big-time MPJ fan. Things didn't work, however, as Porter dropped all the way down to the Denver Nuggets in the middle of the first round due to his injury problems, and the Bulls selected Wendell Carter Jr. with the number 7 overall pick. Later on, with pick number 22, the Bulls took Chandler Hutchison, another good player out of Boise State. And I don't know if anybody noticed this, but the players that went directly before Wendell Carter Jr. and Chandler Hutchison are players who I believe the Bulls were targeting in the first place. But because they were off the board, the Bulls had to settle for Carter Jr. and Hutchison. And now that's not a knock on the players the Bulls got, though. I want to make that clear. The Bulls made some very good moves in this draft. And although I said in previous podcasts that Michael Porter Jr. was the answer, they made a smart move. Because obviously Porter, with his injury problems, could have been another Derrick Rose type situation. And that's not something that the Bulls franchise needs, especially when trying to concoct a rebuild operation. But like I was saying, I found it a bit odd because Mo Bamba went directly before Wendell Carter, and then before Hutchison, Grayson Allen went. And when I was watching the draft and seeing how those two guys were still available, I was thinking to myself, wow, I hope the Bulls land Bamba and Grayson Allen. That would have been quite a haul for the NBA draft. And then the Magic came along and swiped Bamba away. And later in the first round, the Jazz came along and swiped Allen away. And I couldn't believe what I was watching. I was a bit disappointed because those guys really could have helped this team. Bamba's a guy who's over 7 feet, could play the center position, and shoot threes nonetheless. And Grayson Allen, as we all know, played at Duke for 4 years and was a key factor in a couple of their NCAA tournament runs. So both of those guys, I feel like, could have made great contributions in their rookie year on this Bulls team. Nevertheless, the Bulls still did get a quality player in Wendell Carter Jr. and an underrated player in Chandler Hutchison. Now, we've talked about Carter on the show before, but in case you forgot, here are some stats from his one and only season at Duke. Carter played in 37 games and started in all 37 of them, averaging 13.5 points and 9.1 rebounds. The thing that really gets me excited about Carter is the fact that he's basketball savvy in multiple different skills, at least according to his NBA scouting report. He shows potential with his jump shot. He has a high release point and soft touch and can extend his game out to the three-point arc. He's also a very good passer out of the post, and to top that off, he has great hands and timing as a cutter and finisher. So there's a lot to like by the Bulls drafting Wendell Carter Jr. And just think about this for a minute. You've got Wendell Carter Jr., one of the best big men in this draft class, teaming up with Lauri Markkanen, who was voted to the All-NBA Rookie First Team, and last season for Markkanen averaging 15-7. Imagine in 5 years where Markkanen and Carter will be. Imagine where the Bulls will be, for crying out loud, having that tandem at the power forward and center position. And although both guys are still young and inexperienced, in 5 to 10 years, we could see another DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis situation like the one we see in New Orleans right now. That would be sickening. Just thinking about that makes me excited for Bulls basketball in the future. Therefore, Carter getting drafted by the Bulls was an amazing move, especially when considering who else was available at the time. Now, someone who is not receiving much attention, but should be, is the Bulls' other first-round draft pick at 22, Chandler Hutchison, coming out of Boise State. Hutchison last year at Boise State averaged 20 points per game. He played all 4 years there, but really turned it on as a junior, averaging 17-8 on points and rebounds, and last season made it 20-8. And according to his scouting report, Hutchison can do it all, literally. Hutchison last year was a pick-and-roll ball handler. He also made threes, making a career-best 1.5 threes per game, and he shot 42.4% when he was catching and shooting in general. This guy is someone who the Bulls can use as a spark off the bench to begin with, and if he works hard, he can earn his spot in the starting five, beating out Justin Holiday, for example. Hutchison's liabilities include the fact that his jump shot is not reliable. Sometimes he's on, and sometimes he's off. Also, he has problems with his mid-range game. Therefore, some scouting reports say that if he cannot improve upon those aspects, he may need to start his season in the G League. So there's definitely some work to be done for Hutchison, especially during Summer League basketball, if he wants to make an impact at the NBA level in his rookie year. But I feel like Hutchison, who succeeded with Boise State, can come here and at least provide some quality minutes for Fred Hoiberg and for the Bulls. As for my overall grade on the Bulls and their draft day performance, look, they had two players who just slipped out of their hands in Mo Bamba and Grayson Allen. They both went the pick before the Bulls were supposed to pick. But keeping that in mind, I'd say the Bulls get a B+ for what they did. They may not have gotten those two guys, but they got two very good players, guys who I think can contribute at the NBA level sooner rather than later. Moving from the hardwood to the baseball diamond, it's now time to talk about some Chicago Cubs news. Currently, the team is 42-33, 2 games behind the Milwaukee Brewers in the NL Central. Now, there's a reason why the Cubs are only 9 games over 500, and there's definitely a reason why they don't lead the NL Central right now. It's because they got swept in 4 games, nonetheless, by the Cincinnati Reds. And the game on Sunday truly proved to me why it's time to hit the panic button if you're a Chicago Cubs fan. Now, before I unleash my fury with the Cubs, I do want to say this. Their offense is no longer the problem. Lots of guys are doing well, including Albert Almora, who's now hitting .323, and in that game on Sunday had 3 home runs. Yet unfortunately, that wasn't even the story of the game, for crying out loud. Instead, we go to the bottom of the 7th inning. The Cubs are up 6-1 and ready to at least win 1 game out of 4 against the Reds. Yet unfortunately, the Reds' batters, and really the Cubs' bullpen, had other plans. Mike Montgomery was cruising through 6 innings for the Cubs. He came out to start the 7th and gave up 3 straight singles to have the bases loaded. Joe Maddon, at that point, decided to take him out of the game. Next, we witnessed an implosion by Pedro Strop. He went 2/3 of an inning, giving up 4 runs. He was credited with the loss, he was credited with a blown save, and his ERA raised to 2.87. The Cubs, who thought they had a safe lead at 6-1, relinquished it all and lost the game 8-6. They were swept out of Cincinnati, and their deficit in the division became 2 games. At this point, it's just becoming harder and harder to explain what's really going on with the Cubs. One day, they're looking like the team of old, a team that could make it back to the World Series. Yet days like Sunday continue to remind us why that road is not so easy, and how the Cubs have multiple flaws that they need to correct. Now, the kicker for me is that Mike Montgomery was not even supposed to be starting that game on Sunday. it was Tyler Chatwood's turn in the rotation. But as we all know, Chatwood can't throw a ball for a strike, leads all of baseball in walks, and has an ERA just over 4. Quite a showing for a guy who just received a 3-year deal worth almost $13 million per year. And then you've got Yu Darvish still on the DL, a guy who received a $100 million contract, yet when he was on the field, you'd really want him off of it, because he's pitching to an ERA over 5. And Jose Quintana, whom the Cubs acquired from their crosstown rivals for a bundle of prospects, is quite inconsistent, pitching to an ERA over 4. All of these problems overshadow the fact that John Lester is having a Cy Young-esque season with a 9-2 record and an ERA that places third in the National League. And then you've got Kyle Hendricks, a former NL ERA champion whose ERA today is near 4. With all of that in mind, I'm not afraid to say what I'm about to say. This starting rotation will not help the Cubs make it to the World Series, plain and simple. With the exception of John Lester, no one in this rotation has been consistent this year. How am I supposed to trust someone like Jose Quintana to go and start Game 2 of the World Series? The questions that will be running through my mind include, which Jose Quintana am I going to get today? Will it be the one that could throw 6 quality innings of 2-run ball, or will it be the one that will implode in the 5th inning? I shouldn't be too hard on the rotation, though, because the bullpen is nearly 10 times worse. Brian Dunsing, a key pitcher for the Cubs last season, now has an ERA over 6. Pedro Strop just blew a seemingly insurmountable lead the other day, and Justin Wilson, whom the Cubs received in a trade last season for Jaime Candelario and another prospect, has not been the guy in which he was advertised to be. The Cubs' bullpen is in dire straits at this point, and they need to make a move during this trade deadline, or else they're not going anywhere come playoff time. And at this point, talking about the playoffs is optimistic. I remember in 2004 when the Cubs were locked into a wild card spot, yet in the final couple weeks of the season, LaTroy Hawkins blew multiple saves, and the bullpen couldn't get the job done, and sure enough, the Cubs missed the playoffs. I sure don't want to see that happen this year. Moves need to be made and things need to be done in order for the Cubs to seriously think about contending this year. Because what we just witnessed this past weekend, where the Cubs got swept by the Reds, isn't going to get it done come October. Moving to the south side, it's now time to talk about some Chicago White Sox news. Currently, the White Sox are 26-51, 17.5 games out of the AL Central Division lead. First off, I'd like to say this. I've talked to many White Sox fans about Yoan Moncada and his eventual role in the major leagues. I've made the argument numerous times and vehemently at times that he's a bust, while others have disagreed with me. Well, Moncada is now making a run for his money after his performance on Sunday versus the A's. Moncada, who entered the game hitting .224 with 26 RBIs, recorded 6 RBIs with a 3-run homer and a 3-RBI double as he led the White Sox to a 10-3 win. Many have claimed that this is Moncada's coming out party and that he's finally ready for the big leagues. Fortunately, you've got me here to tell you the truth about what Moncada is going to do. And that's the fact that just because he's had one good game doesn't mean that now all of a sudden he's an all-star. On the season, he's still hitting .228 and his OPS is barely above 700. Tell me how that's living up to the expectation of the number one overall prospect in Major League Baseball. Look, he had a good game against a bad team. Although the A's are sitting around the 500 mark, the pitcher that day was Paul Blackburn, who this season holds an ERA near 9, and he's 1-2 as a starter. You're going to tell me that succeeding off of a pitcher like Paul Blackburn proves that you're good enough to be in the major leagues and that you're living up to your expectations of being a flat-out superstar? I don't think so. This is Moncada's third year in the major leagues, believe it or not. He played 8 games with Boston, hitting .211. He played last season here in Chicago and hit .231, and this year he's hitting .228. That doesn't sound too good for a top prospect now, does it? Being completely transparent here, the White Sox received the Red Sox worst prospect in that trade with Chris Sale, Look at Rafael Devers, a second-year player on the Red Sox. He's hitting 13 home runs. Andrew Benintendi's hitting nearly 300 and is an early AL MVP candidate. Yet the White Sox get Yoan Moncada, a guy who is still yet to hit his stride in the major leagues? Come on now. I just don't see the potential and the hype surrounding Moncada. This is his third year in the majors. He's yet to do anything. At this point, it's time to call him a bust and move on to the other prospects that you have in your farm system. If I were the White Sox, I'd worry about the guys down there, not Yoan Moncada at the major league level, a guy who's still struggling to find his way. In other White Sox news, Eloy Jimenez, the team's top prospect, has been promoted to AAA Charlotte. Jimenez is hitting .317 with a .925 OPS in AA, and that warranted his promotion. So White Sox fans, point being here, the future is almost here. This is a very exciting time if you're a White Sox fan, as you'll get to see all of these top prospects begin to debut. And with Jimenez succeeding so much offensively down in AA and AAA, I feel that he's ready to even play in the majors at this point. But either way, that's someone the White Sox should be focusing on, not Yoan Moncada and his struggles at the major league level. But Sox fans, stay patient, because your time is coming. We now move to the gridiron for some Chicago Bears news. Now, the team is not doing anything currently. Training camp starts later in July, but an interesting article has surfaced online about some possible trade candidates during the preseason. Topping the list is none other than wide receiver and bust himself, Kevin White. Here's what the article has to say. I'll read it verbatim. Kevin White hasn't proved anything on an NFL field up to this point in his career, and now he's entering the last year of his contract. The Bears still appear to be supporting him 100%, and he's back to putting in extra work this offseason to get back on the field in 2018. The wide receiver depth chart has a lot of talent ahead of White, with the top three, Allen Robinson, Taylor Gabriel, and Anthony Miller, all essentially locked in. I am so relieved to hear what I just heard. Kevin White getting traded is the best thing that the Bears could do at this point. Cut ties with those bad memories. I mean, my goodness, how much longer are the Bears going to be holding out in hopes that Kevin White can come back, number one, and two, make an impact? It's absurd that the Bears are even thinking about having him play this season. As the article mentioned, you've got three accomplished wide receivers ahead of White. Allen Robinson, a former 1,500-yard guy, Taylor Gabriel, the two or three on the Falcons, and Anthony Miller, whom the Bears drafted this year and have lots of hopes for. You're going to tell me that Kevin White deserves to play over any one of those three guys? You've got another thing coming. And what really gets me mad about Kevin White is when looking back at the draft, the Bears had so many other options that they passed up to take Kevin White. I mean, right after White, Vic Beasley was drafted. Todd Gurley afterwards, Melvin Gordon, Marcus Peters, the list goes on and on. The Bears lost an opportunity in that draft, yet they're going to give another opportunity back to Kevin White? That's it, it's over. He can't make it onto the field, he's never healthy. When he's on the field, he's a non-factor. Get rid of him already. I'm so happy to see that his name is on the trade block at this point because he has no use to the Bears, and in fact, he may have no use to any NFL team. It's going to be hard to get rid of him, but if the Bears somehow find a way, I'll be the happiest guy in the world. On a quick final note, Bears training camp starts July 21st for opening weekend. But until then, everyone can only wait in anticipation for the Bears and their 2018 season. And before we get to our special guest, it's time to talk about some Chicago Blackhawks news. Right now, the Hawks are very active on the free agent market as they've reached out to unrestricted free agent goaltender Carter Hutton. Last season with St. Louis, Hutton posted a 17-7-3 record with a 2.09 goals against average and a .931 save percentage in 32 games. With those stats, Hutton is a hot commodity as the Hawks and seven other teams have reached out. Although, it'd be nice if the Hawks could get him and have him either start or back up Corey Crawford, because obviously this past season, the goaltender position has been a problem. With the injuries to Crawford and insufficient backups, the Hawks will need someone like Hutton to succeed next year. Hutton cannot sign a free agent contract, however, until July 1st, when the NHL's free agency period officially begins. So until then, the Hawks have their chance to make a pitch to Hutton to have him come here to Chicago. In other Hawks news, the team has acquired forward Michael Chaput from the Vancouver Canucks in exchange for forward Tanner Kerrow. Chaput spent his time last season with the Canucks and Utica Comets of the American Hockey League, and he finished second on the club with 42 points. In 9 games with Vancouver last year, he was held scoreless but won 58.1% of his faceoffs. Chaput looks to make an impact for this Hawks team, and they need a spark badly after last season. Hopefully he and other free agents could make an impact with the Hawks for this upcoming season. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his NFL career with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in 1995. By 1997, he made his first of 7 Pro Bowl appearances, while being named Defensive Player of the Year in 1999. In 2002, he led Tampa Bay to their first and only Super Bowl victory. Today, he is a Pro Football Hall of Fame inductee and the host of the Route 99 podcast. Please welcome the great Warren Sapp to the show. Warren, how are you doing today? And thank you for taking the time to be on the show.
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, Warren, I'd like to take a look back at your illustrious NFL career. I mean, in the bio, I just named some of your many accomplishments. There are so many more that we didn't talk about, including your all-pro selections on defense as well. What was your secret to success, and how'd you make the transition from being a college standout to an NFL legend?
I got lucky, and getting lucky means you got to put a lot of hard work and dedication and have some real hard-hitting brothers around you that love the same type of work you love. And I always pointed to Tony Dungy and Rob Marinelli, who are the two people that in my career, early in my career, who pointed me in the right direction and said, this is how you get there.
Now, when you first started in the NFL, you were on a Tampa Bay team that was not ready to win, to say the least. I mean, you guys had a quarterback in Trent Dilfer, who threw 18 interceptions against 4 touchdowns, and the team went 7-9. How difficult was it for you as a rookie to maintain such a competitive mindset?
Listen, I went to Derek Brooks, and I said, listen, how many games did you lose in college? And I think he said 6. Oh. I said, I lost 5. I said, this is not what we come here for, so we got to do something about this. Then we grabbed John Lynch off the back end, and Hardy Nickerson, and Lonnie Marks, and some other brothers, and I tell you, Tony Dungy came in, and he gave us a structure, and he said, fellas, this is how you get it done. You must be accountable to each other, no excuses, no explanations, and we loved it, and we went at it. We went 6-10 the next year, but after that, we took off. I mean, we had some growing pains and some learning pains with, you know, being able to stay in your gap and turn the ball the right way and trust your teammate gonna be there. But, you know, it was a great learning process.
It's good that you ended up staying hungry because, as you mentioned, with Tony Dungy coming over, in 1997, you guys went 10-6 and made the playoffs, and you made your first of 7 consecutive Pro Bowls. So what went right for that year, personally for you and then for the team itself?
That quarterback he was talking about. Trent made his first Pro Bowl, too, because, I mean, what did he go, 19-12 that year, I think, with touchdowns against interceptions? And, I mean, you know, when you talk about 4-18 and then you go to 19-12, it really gives you a chance to win football games when you're not turning the football over. And that's the one thing we took out of our game out here in Tampa was turning the football over, making a bunch of dumb mistakes, and the big plays on defense, because all those Barry Sanders highlights I saw in those Cadillac commercials was against the Bucks when I was in college.
And after that season, you guys made the playoffs in a stretch from 1999 through 2002, and of course that's a far cry from your first couple of years in Tampa. Did you ever imagine, you know, when you started, the team achieving as much as it did?
Me and Derek Brooks talk about winning a championship and having a parade down Tampa, down the middle of downtown Tampa. We didn't know it would go all the way around Bayshore, around the lake. So we had a real good time. We were like, oh my God, Brooks, I didn't know they was going to give us the lake too. part of the bay, not the lake, part of the bay. You know, we came around the bay and then went up over the bridge, right down through the middle of 70, went right through downtown. I'm like, that's what I'm talking about, Brooks. And people were hanging out of parking garages. It was the greatest day ever. We had talked about it for a good 8 years, but we got it done.
You know, in that Super Bowl in 2002, you know, you guys came in as underdogs, and judging by the final score of the game, it's kind of weird that you guys came in as underdogs in the beginning. How'd you flip the script to end up winning that Super Bowl championship?
It was a two-time MVP, and Rich Gannon, Jerry Rice, Tim Brown, these are Hall of Famers, you know what I'm saying? Basically, not the quarterback, but the other two receivers are Hall of Famers, and they had the number one offense, and Nobody thought we could even come close to slowing them down, but we had a plan and we executed it. It was just our moment. I mean, I remember walking in the meeting on Thursday night and I told the boys when I handed out the bracelet to all of them, I said, because we're only as strong as our weakest link. And don't be the weakest link on Sunday, because if you are, I'll never speak to you again.
What an inspirational message.
Oh, no. It was all in the bag. We had to did all the work. It was all in the work, and I knew we were ready to go. So that's why I said what I said, because nobody even thought about a weekly. Like, I'm going to make me a play tomorrow. I'm making a play on Sunday. I was like, that's what I'm talking about. So we were ready to go. They ran into the wrong defense at the wrong time.
And once the time ran out, what did it feel like to be crowned a Super Bowl champion, especially the way you guys started and the way you came in the NFL with all of the misery in Tampa Bay? What did it feel like to cap that all off with the Super Bowl championship in 2002?
It's something that could never be taken away from you. We're champions forever. Forever and a day, they have to say Super Bowl champion, world champion. They have to say it. That's like put that hat on, my man. When I walked to the sideline after Brooks ran that touchdown in, being him over there, he'd go to crying. I said, don't make me cry. Yeah. So I push him away from me. I look up and somebody's got a hat. Oh, I know it. Ellis Williams got it. Big dog. And he got his hat on. I said, you got a hat on? And he looked at me and said, I got you one. I said, well, that's what I'm talking about right there, baby. You got the big dog hat. I said, hey, I'm done. I gave my helmet up at that point, and it was over right then. I was a world champion. I had my hat on.
You know, I was curious. Did you have any special stories or favorite memories during the game or after winning it all?
Oh, yeah. The Deacon Jones story, I call it.
Okay.
What's the one thing every team does after they win a championship?
Pour champagne, you know, celebrate.
Pop champagne. Yeah. Listen, we walked into the locker room, and we were putting our clothes in plastic bags. We were putting our clothes in garbage bags. I hit that locker room, and I had a magnum bottle of Cristal 1985 champagne. A friend of mine gave me down in Tampa, Larry Goodridge, the head of Southern Wine and Spirit. I still have that bottle in my refrigerator, because when I walked in the locker room, I had two NFL security dudes standing by my cooler, and he was like, don't even think about it. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, what are you talking about? I just won a world championship. I'm supposed to pop champagne. And it was like, you will not even pop a Budweiser in this locker room. I'm like, oh, my God. So that's my Deacon Jones story, because when I met Deacon Jones in 1998 at the thing, and he was talking about this and that, whatever, then I saw him later on. He was like, I know you pour champagne everywhere, baby. I'm like, they wouldn't let me pop a Budweiser, dog. You should have seen his face. It's like I just took his soul out. I guess he had never asked anybody else before this. But when I told Deacon Jones that you cannot pop a Budweiser in the locker room after winning a Super Bowl, he got up from the bar and said, I'm going home. He left. I saw the next day, he was like, you got to be kidding me, right? I'm like, no, they don't let... He's like, that's the most hurtful thing I've ever heard in my life. So that's... You know, I thought of Deacon Jones. I'm like, hey, well, he let me pop a Budweiser here, man. This is crazy. I didn't believe it. I hadn't asked anybody before that either. You know, like, y'all pop champagne, you know? You know, because you hear the story of Mookie, you know the Mookie Blaylock story when Mookie, you know, hits the ball down there, it goes to Ray Knight's legs, Buckner's legs, Mookie scores. They gotta rip down all the plastic and get all the champagne out of the locker room before Boston gets in there.
Right.
You hear these stories? I mean, I'm running the mind. I'm like, oh boy, we finna have us a party. No. I see you at the hotel, fat boy.
Okay, so something that I found a bit odd is that you win the Super Bowl, completely demoralize the Raiders, but during the offseason of 2003, you then decided to join Oakland. So what prompted that decision, and why did you end up leaving Tampa?
All right. I get on the free agency happens. I'm a 7 straight time Pro Bowler, Defensive Player of the Year, World Champion, all that. And I'm a free agent. Marvin Lewis is at the Florida State workout that morning with some kids working out. Drew Rosenhaus is there, my agent. Marvin Lewis say, I want Warren on the team. We're going to do the same thing they did in Tampa, bring a championship to Cincinnati. I said, okay. Rosenhaus, get on the phone with me. It's 9 o'clock. Free agency is open now. Hey, man, we got an offer on the table. I'm like, yo, do your thing. You know, I'm not sure about Cincinnati, but do your thing. So he, you know, he does his thing. I say, you know the deal. I want a 4-year deal, $20 million, and I'm out. I take a $1 million pay cut. I was making $6 million a year. I'll take a $1 million pay cut. I'm over 30. I understand the NFL. That's business. No problem. He gets the deal all locked up. Mike Brown tells him we got an hour to accept the deal. I wait 56 minutes because John Gruden told me, whenever you get an offer, you call me as soon as you get that offer. So I turned and called John after I got off the phone with Drew. I said, I got an offer. It's around $16 to $20 million for 4 years. That's a budget after I just got paid $40 million in Tampa. So, you know, this should be a no-brainer, right? We hold a crew together. We run out another championship and see what happens, right? 57 minutes later, I didn't get a call back. I called Drew back. I said, accept the offer. I got in my car. I went to Tampa and cleaned my lockout. Yep, I drove to the job and cleaned my lockout.
That's quite a story, you know, because... You know,
that's life.
Yeah.
That's life. You don't want your stuff coming to your house in a garbage bag.
Right. No, definitely.
Oh, that's how they send it to you.
Wow.
When you get cut in the National Football League, they put your stuff in a garbage bag and they ask you where you want to ship. Oh, I've been in the league at that point for 9 years and I knew what was coming. They would go pack my stuff up in a garbage bag. I'm like, I got my baby pictures down there and all kind of stuff. I got 9 years worth of that. Ain't no way you finna put that in a garbage bag. I'm finna go pick that up and put it in the car nice and, you know, like you leaving your office. Like they let you pack up and security there for you to walk you out of your office. I just didn't have the security, you know, cause guys came by like, you know, Monty Kiffin, Rod Marinelli and, you know, Raheem and a couple other guys like, what you doing, Cizo? I'm like, dog, I called Gruden and told him I had an offer from Cincinnati. He didn't call back. I had to take the offer from Cincinnati. What am I supposed to do? I got kids to feed, man. I got to go to work. So after I get finished cleaning out, the story gets better. So after I clean out my locker, say my emotional goodbye to my D coordinator, my, you know, D-line coach and, you know, the trainer I have had since I was in college, Todd Tortelli. Me and him been together 9 years. He said, damn, we won't make it to a decade, fella. I'm like, don't worry about it, baby. 9 was good enough. You got your championship ring, right? He's like, yeah. I'm like, well, that's all we talking about. So let's get up out of here. So I walked out the door with my last box, get in the car. Rosenhaus called me and said, Mike Brown has said he was bidding against himself. We are now a free agent again. We don't have a contract with Cincinnati.
Wow.
Yeah. Mike Brown rescinds his offer after, you know, telling me I got an hour to accept it. We call back within an hour. He says no. Rosenhaus sit there for 10, 15 minutes talking with him. I'm at the locker room cleaning out my locker. I get back in the car. I don't have a contract, and nor do I have a locker in Tampa anymore.
Wow, that is just quite a turn of events.
Oh, yeah. So I tell myself I'm going to get on a plane and go down to Miami, and I'm going to enjoy myself since I don't have a job and I don't have a place to go work out anymore. So I go down to Miami, watch the Miami Heat play somebody, wake up the next morning, Rosenhaus called me bright and early, 9 o'clock. Al Davis is on the phone, and he said he's not getting off until you are a Raider. And that is it. You need to know no more about it. When Al Davis says you are the Golden Goose, you are coming to Oakland.
Well, after your four-year stint in Oakland, you had decided to retire. So how did it feel retiring from the game? And, you know, what was it like to see your career come to an end the way it did?
I saw my career come to the end in Green Bay Week 16. Brett Favre came out of the huddle after halftime, had that little shimmy shake. He always thought, oh, I know that look. That's play action pass. Came off the ball, Coolidge, number 73, the left guard, beat to grab me, and I knew it was passed. I tried to put my move on him. He got me locked up. I mean, locked up. Brett Favre done faked it, went back, dropped back, hit that fifth step, jumped up, and launched one. I go to watching it in the air. I'm like, oh, my goodness. You know, I mean, I played him twice a year for 6-7 years when I first got in the league, and they kept it going all the way into 2002. I at least played him once. I mean, this man launched this ball. This the longest ball I ever seen him throw. Donald Driver's on the end. It's an 85-yard touchdown. I said, I got to go home. I said, when a quarterback comes out of the, breaks the huddle, does his little shimmy, and I know it's play-action pass, and I can't beat the guard that's in front of me, yeah, time to go home. Time to go home. 100 sacks, 6-7 wins, and all, because you know that most of the games I ever won in Oakland was 5 the first year I was there. 5-4, 2-2.
Oh, my goodness.
What was it? No, 5-4, 2-4. Oh. That's what it was. 5-4, 2-4. Yeah, I won 15 games in 4 years. I didn't lose that bad in Tampa, and Tampa had 11 straight double-digit loss seasons when I got here. 11 straight double-digit loss seasons when I got here, and I didn't lose that much in Tampa. So I was ready to go home, and I was 3,000 miles from my babies and my mom. Oh, this was the clincher. Monday Night Football, we were playing Seattle. In this particular season, we had played 3 nationally televised games, and we averaged 1 point a night.
My goodness.
We scored 3. Yeah, we got shut out twice, and we scored 3 points another night. We kicked the field goal with Janikowski. So the only thing you got to do is get within 60-something yards, and he's kicking it. So that's how bad we were. So I'm on Monday Night Football playing Mike Holmgren and his Seattle Seahawks when he went up there. You know, I do my scout report. I'm like, Mike's going to throw this thing around like he always does. I get a chance to show out on Monday Night Football and attack the quarterback. If you look this one up, I'm all over Seneca Wallace. I'm knocking him around, whacking him, having a good time. We lose 16-3, but, you know, I had a good game, and it was my birthday. 2 days later is my birthday, so I called my mom, like, Ma, I know you saw your boy last night on Monday Night Football cutting up doing the Michael Jackson. She said, boy, if I want to watch somebody get killed, I watch Law and Order. My quarterback had got sacked 9 times in the first half.
Wow.
Yeah, 7 and 9 for the total game. Got sacked 7 times in the first half and 9 for the game. I've had bad O-lines and great defensive fronts, and we getting 6 in a day, and we feeling great about it. I'm like, man, 7.5! My mother like, they almost killed that boy. I said, Ma, I'll talk to you later. I'm like, happy birthday. I hung up the phone. I'm like, oh my God, I gotta get out of here. They made my mama turn on Monday Night Football. Ain't no way. And I was having a good game. Ain't no way my mama turned off the TV last night.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, y'all boys in Oakland, babe, my mama. I went to the job and told him. I said, I'm out of here, dog. No, dog. We gon'. I said, dog, I'm out of here. I said, y'all made my mama turn off Monday Night Football last night, dog. I'm done with y'all. I am done with y'all. I am out of here. I'm never coming back.
So, 6 years after you announced your retirement, you were officially inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. How much did that honor mean to you?
I'm a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Correct.
The 74th one. The great, and this is the, you want to hear a great story? This is Groundhog Day, February the 2nd, 2013. And that's the day they make the announcement. It's Groundhog Day. So, you know me, I'm a kid, I'm 40 plus. I remember Bill Murray. We could do Groundhog Day every day of the year like that if that's the day we're talking about. Oh, my God. But it was a gut-wrenching day because in football, we play the ultimate team sport. No one man is bigger than the team. No one man going to win his game by himself. No one man going to do anything on a football field except be a cog in a lovely engine and get it done, right? No. When you're in the Hall of Fame, up for the Hall of Fame, it's just you. No Derrick Brooks, no John Lynch, no cover two, no nothing. It's just you. You're all along on a wire about the greatest team sport we know.
That's kind of odd then, you know, how...
That's a lonely ass feeling, my friend.
Exactly.
Trust me. And then people want to shove a camera in your face and watch your reaction to if you get into the Hall of Fame. You know how crazy that is? You know how crazy that is? I mean, because I'm older than the knock on the door bullshit that they're doing now. You know what I'm saying? I would have never been involved in anything like that. There's no way you will even know where I'm at that moment when they announce who's in the Hall of Fame. I was in a room with three of my closest homeboys, and we were watching this thing, and I'm yelling and screaming with my little tank top on and my boxers, just yelling at the TV. Because I'm watching it like everybody else is watching it. I'm watching the announcements just like everybody. And the best part about this is my homeboy actually set a phone up in the back of the room and recorded the whole thing. So we watch this every year, and we laugh. Oh, my God, we laugh at this. Oh, my God. I'm yelling at the TV, and they laughing at me. They're like, boys, either we going to have us a good moment, or he going to break that TV off the wall. Oh, man. It was a range of emotions that I had never been through in my life. And I'm talking about, I've been in a lot of different situations, but that right there is the ultimate. And when you get accepted, oh, it's nothing like it. I mean, 2 weeks later, Willie Lanier called me on the phone, number 131 in the Hall of Fame, and said, you're engaged. I'm like, I don't remember getting on my knees or buying a ring. What happened? He's like, no, you're engaged to the Hall of Fame, and we'll see you on Gold Jacket Friday night. You got it, young man? I said, yes, sir. I see you right there, boss. No problem. I mean, Willie Lanier? No problem, brother. I'll be right there for you. Unbelievable. So, I mean, the club itself is something, when you get to walk in every summer and sit down with Jim Brown, and he slaps you on the back, say, hey, young man, how's everything going? And you sit down and have lunch with him and sit there and talk with him and his wife. I mean, Floyd Little sitting right there. I mean, Mean Joe Green. I mean, come on. I'm a kid in the candy shop every summer. I get to go eat with the greatest that has ever played the game and some of the most influential men that's ever walked on the face of God's green earth. So, hey, count me in. Let Terrell Owens hear that, please. Come on, Terrell. You gotta come join us, man.
You gotta come join us, man. Why do you think he's not doing it?
I don't know, because, you know, I've talked to about 10 or 12 Hall of Famers, and we all in agreement that that moment, you have to step into that light and talk about your grandmama and talk about all the people that helped you got to the off of that dirt road in Tennessee. Are you crazy? Hey, no, and cry and let us feel it. Cause now it's worthy of being cried over. Shit, we never saw Michael Jordan cry unless he had a championship or standing in the Hall of Fame. So it's all good. It's all good. Come on home, baby. You've been called home. Come on home and sit with the greats. Cause at no time did anyone in that room in the last 3 years ever say to me, yeah, he don't deserve to be here. Never. we were sitting around like, are you kidding me? like, are you kidding me? Like, I take him on my team every day of the week and twice on Sunday. Are you kidding me? He's a monster. Oh.
You know, I wanted to shift to the game today because it's under some scrutiny, especially with the NFL recently banning players from kneeling during the national anthem on the field. I wanted to get
okay. Why don't we just go back to when we announced the team and we played football? Because this was a directive by the U.S. military to get more people to volunteer for the military. It was just a campaign, and they was paying the NFL to do this. They was paying the NFL and paying for flyovers and everything. I was in Tampa and McDill when the stealth used to fly right over the top of us.
That's interesting, then, because, you know, I didn't know that for sure, and I'm sure a lot of other people don't, you know that bad.
Oh, they do. They do. I mean, you just got to pay attention to the issue and not turn it into something about disrespecting our servicemen or anything like that. Because Colin Kaepernick got the kneeling from a Green Beret.
Definitely. You know, I was going to ask you, does Colin Kaepernick deserve to be on an NFL team right now?
Oh, no doubt. Are you kidding me with some of these quarterbacks they have in the National Football League right now? Are you kidding me? This ain't even something we're talking about. Who was the guy that played all last year in Indianapolis?
Jacoby Brissett.
Right. And I ain't got no problem with Jacoby or Brissett. You know, I sound like two different people. I mean, come on, give me a break, man. Stop that, man. Come on. Kenny Hill down in Miami making it a disaster. The Jets still looking for anybody to even look like Chad Pennington to just complete some passes. They ain't looking for Joe Namath. They just looking for somebody to complete some passes now. You got a man that went all the way to the back-to-back championships and a Super Bowl. Are you kidding me? Come on, man. And the only thing to knock on this kid was that Harbaugh used to tell him, drop back and throw it here. Not read it. You know, drop back and throw here. You know, are you kidding me? Come on, man. Let's stop this. Stop this. This man shook up a whole a mega billion-dollar corporation to where Pepsi, Coca-Cola, American Express, Visa, and some people were a little uncomfortable because they wasn't paying attention to what he was talking about. Because it wasn't their child that they have to tell when you get pulled over, turn the inside light on, and put all 10 fingers up on the steering wheel.
That's interesting, too, because for Kaepernick, you know, there are other people kneeling now, and no one's facing the problems that he is. You know, why is that as well? What do you think that's going on?
I learned something a long time ago in the world of football. The quarterback gets way too much credit, and he gets way too much blame.
That makes sense.
Hey, that's been an additive since day one when you talk about a quarterback. Quarterback gets way too much credit and gets way too much blame.
Well, I wanted to shift gears now and talk about your new podcast called the Route 99 Podcast. Why did you decide to do it, and what can listeners expect from the show?
You know what? I got too many opinions. I be yelling at the TV like that like that episode with my homeboys in the Hall of Fame. And us watching that year after year. And they looking at me like, come on, dog, do a podcast, man. It's under your own control. You get to do what you want to do, how you want to do it, say what you want to say, and be as informative, abusive, loving, caring, whatever you want to be. And after sitting for about 2 years, I'm like, all right, why not? And I want you to take a ride with me because sometimes we need to put a little different spin on it. Because everybody does. And, you know, we're in our corners, you know, like I hear about the Oakland lady that called the people, called the police on the people. Well, actually, they were in the wrong spot. And I've never heard anybody say that except one, the Oakland place that dug into it. You just had to have propane. They weren't using propane. And if you watch King of the Hill, you know what I'm talking about. They weren't using propane. If that's a propane part, then gotta use the propane. I mean, some people don't like the smell of charcoal or, you know, that aroma of barbecue like that. Some people like propane. And if your pop says you got to use propane in this area, you got to use propane in this area. Because evidently the pop didn't have a range of going around making sure everybody was in the right spot. And the excuse the man used is the wildest thing ever. I've been doing this since my daddy. That don't make it right. That don't make it right. I mean, let's just abide by the rules. If everybody abide by the rules, then we all get along a lot better. It's that simple. Now, the lady with the water on the side of the road, they're calling about the little girl selling water, now that's a whole nother level. I mean, relax. I mean, it's a dollar water. Jesus Christ. You don't want the water, keep walking. You know, I know one thing. We've gotten too damn sensitive in this country. We've got too damn sensitive. I mean, everything bothers somebody. I mean, like, are you kidding me? The one thing that bothers me that people need to stop, because I'm a loud fella. But I'm just, that's just my voice. That's just how I talk. I'm not yelling. That's just how I am. But I watch people on their phone in public places like they're in their living room. Oh, come on, take it down two notches. Nobody's filming you. Your YouTube channel is not on right now. Stop it. Slow it down. I mean, who are you on stage for right now? Everybody's looking for their 15 minutes right now, boy. Good God Almighty. Holy Toledo. I guess I've had my 15 minutes, so I'm kind of used to it, or don't want it anymore. but Ernie, I mean, come on, Ernie, 15 minutes. Jesus, everybody, it's unbelievable. Everybody's in an act phase now. Oh, Jesus Christ.
And on a final note, I wanted to ask about your confrontation with Mike Sherman after your game against the Packers in 2002.
Oh, no. Define confrontation for me.
Confrontation? Oh, I don't know. Maybe, you know, meeting up with him after the game and exchanging some choice words. And that's what I was going to ask you. What was said in that confrontation and conversation itself?
It's been 16 years now, right? I didn't share it then because I told everybody to ask Mike what he said. Mike still hadn't shared what he said, and I don't think many people have asked him. But what I did share with the world, that if Mike wanted some, go get you a jersey. And put it on. Put on the jersey, baby. You want some of this? Put on the jersey, because I'm not allowed to punch you in your damn mouth right now and get myself an assault charge and be away from my children. That's what he was looking for, because he wanted to call me an out of control wild man and la la la. Well, I know what it was going on. You gotta play. You might try lotto. You might get one number right. But when you come to 99, it's very simple to get it right. Meet him face to face on the other side of the line and snap the damn ball.
Well put, Warren, and thank you so much for being here on the show today. It was an unbelievable pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
No, my pleasure, my brother. I love your show. And anytime you want me back, you give us a buzz.
Of course. No, thank you so much.
All right.
Well, there you have it. My interview with Warren Sapp today was nothing but fun and enjoyable as we talked about his great career, his new podcast, and so many stories along the way. Warren, it was an honor to have you on the show, and thank you for making the time to come on. And with that, it's now time for our closing segment, the announcer's call of the day. Here's the situation. Dodgers are facing the Mets, and they're winning 4-2 in the top of the eighth inning. There's one out, bases are loaded, and Matt Kemp is stepping in. Let's listen to former guest on this show, Joe Davis, make an outstanding call.
Kemp swings. It's a high fly ball to left. Nimmo's back. That is a grand slam for Matt Kemp. And the Dodgers have broken things open in the eighth.
What a call there by Joe Davis. And you know, it's interesting because that was a national Fox game. So he couldn't be that animated about his beloved Dodgers hitting a home run, hitting a grand slam rather. But still an excellent call by one of our former guests in Joe Davis. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. A special thank you to Warren Sapp for coming on today's show. What an interview and what a time we had together. And finally, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can enter your email in on the subscription box on the homepage. Once you do that and confirm in your inbox, you will be able to receive the latest articles and podcasts directly to your email. Thank you again for listening to today's show, and have a great day.